You're listening to 99.1 WQRT LP Indianapolis, and this is Create Here. Produced by artists and curators from Big Car Collaborative, Create Here is your place to listen to conversations with people making intriguing, innovative, and impactful things happen on the cultural front in Indianapolis, Indiana, and beyond. Find out more and access additional episodes at WQRT.org.
Hello. Welcome to Create Here. Today we're joined by artist Kelvin Berzon. I'm Shate Marsh, co-founder of Big Car, director of programming and exhibitions, and Kelvin is getting ready to open an exhibit with us. Kelvin Berzon's recent work addresses, but does not attempt to resolve, the tension between religion and homosexuality. He examines religion's traditions, imagery, theatrically, and psychological vestige. By appropriating religious imagery and language, the work is recontextualized by the insertion of LGBTQ members and activists. Berzon's work has been exhibited abroad and all over the country and is part of several permanent collections, including the Kinsey Institute and the Center for Photography at Woodstock. Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tell me a bit about how you started, like, what gave you the idea to make this body of work? And can you also start, let's talk a bit about what it looks like for the viewers who haven't been able to see it yet.
Ooh, okay. It started really when, my beginning relationship with photography, and automatically photography was this immediate thing, and it was very romantic. I fell in love with, the whole process and its magic and its ability to create a sense of intimacy between the viewer and the subject matter and the power that is behind the camera. And early on, I was really afraid to address anything that I'm addressing now, and early self-portraiture that I was making was difficult for me because I didn't want my self-portraiture to be about anything that I was, because I was not ready to talk about it. I was not ready to talk about being an immigrant or being queer or, to talk about anything political. But it was a political event that initiated this project, and it was in March 2015, I remember distinctly because it happened on my birthday. And it was the passing of RFRA, or RFR, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that was passed by then Governor of Indiana, Mike Pence. And, trying to escape all these things that I was fighting internally, it became this event that was national news, and everybody was arguing for and against it. And I started talking to people in my community and examining how I felt about this relationship of being queer and being religious, especially growing up in the Philippines and Roman Catholic colonized background and imagery. And so I had to address it, and that's where it began. To describe the work, it really is this homage and veneration to the romance of and the visual language of Catholicism and Christianity, from inspirations from Baroque paintings. Caravaggio is a big inspiration. The art that I grew up with in the churches of Orani Bataan, Philippines, in my parish church that I went to school at. These are the images that I'm mimicking, and the narratives that I'm inserting my own story and the story of individuals like me into.
The wood in the works is like a deep, dark mahogany. I don't think it is mahogany, mm-hmm. I'm guessing, but it's very beautiful, ornately carved. The subjects in your work, really, like, it's beautiful. Like, your pieces are exquisite. And already, I've had people ask me if they're paintings. and, you know, they'll be like, is this a painting? Mm-hmm. And I'll say no. And but also you had said in the past that when it comes to the costumes, when it comes to creating these icons, you sewed mm-hmm. the costumes, and so what was the process? So did you see it in your mind and then sketch it and then create these pieces? How, or did you see the people in it first mm-hmm. and then thought of what they symbolize to you? Can you talk about that?
Again, it roots with my relationship to photography, and you know, early photographers in academia are taught to seek out moments, to, you know, Henri Cartier-Bresson talks about the decisive moment, and as a photographer, you're programmed to go and find that. And that was never my love in photography. I had to construct this moment. I had to create the moment to capture as a performance in front of the camera, as opposed to seeking it. And so fabrication and getting my hand into the photograph has always been a part of my practice. And complete control is always what I'm after in my practice. And, you know, from knowing exactly the stain of the wood that will be used for the frame, and that is the stain that I use for each prop that I create for the photograph, the colors that will be in the gels will be the same colors that will be in the wardrobe. And it's all controlled and thought up prior to. And a big part of my research and my practice in sketching is that I go and do it myself first before I ask anybody to. And I think that comes from being a performer and a dancer, is I would sketch the scene out with myself. You know, I'll wear the costume, I'll see how the lighting's gonna work, I'll try out the props, and, you know, see how I want the movement and how the posture and how, you know, it's going to translate to another person. And it's different for each piece. Sometimes it's really inspired by a narrative that was told to me when I was young, or a current event, or a conversation that I had in the studio with the model. Like if the model comes in and, you know, says, oh, my confirmation saint was this saint, then I am willing to completely turn around and find a narrative that can suit that sitter.
When it comes to the people and the subjects in your work, the models, how did you select them?
I can touch on the Lure series, which was kind of mentioned in the last time that I was here. And it was referred to as the Grindr series. And that was kind of my initiation in how to contact people and how to approach people. And so the Lure series was early experimentation on the power of the photographer and the power of the camera. You know, once a sitter sits in front of the camera, they ask you for permission. They ask you, oh, how should I have my hands? Should I put my face like this? My body should be like this. And so the photographer is given so much power. And so this project, which halted immediately, I maybe have several images in it. And so maybe one day I'll return to that project. But I was luring men in using dating apps, Grindr in particular. And, you know, as a commentary on this sexual kind of predatory culture, especially in the queer community. And so I was luring men into the photographic studio, and I would, you know, kind of test how far I can push this person and the power that I have sexually and with the camera. And, you know, I would use the camera as a barrier, but also as this like magic wand that, oh, take your shirt off. And then I would also take my shirt off to make them feel more comfortable and to create this strange sexual tension. And then that is sincerely captured via the lens. Mm-hmm. But that was my initiation into how to gather people. But I eventually found that that was not the way that No Limit Hangere should be casted mm-hmm. in a theatrical sense. I approach people that was near and dear to me, like my sister or my cousin who's also queer, or people that are close to me that are seriously affected by this psychological crisis or trauma that is, you know, brought upon by this weird conflict of religion and sexuality.
Yeah, it's almost like the desire is traumatic, mm-hmm. And being able to process that and having a tool in which to process it. How did you feel like you were able to, with the Lure series, process, you know, that trauma that desire creates? And did like, how would, did you ever keep in contact with any of those subjects, or, you know, were they given copies of the pieces? Mm. How did that work?
So the Lure series, I wasn't really interested in the person. You know, the portraiture wasn't about these people. It was about the culture and our connection in that moment to create this intense duet that just happened for an hour in a studio that's, you know, this performance was captured photographically. I was not interested in really getting to know them or seeing how they are in the future. And I think that's what I learned I wasn't really into. And so that completely changed with my current work. And I found that the investment in the people was so much more powerful to me as an artist, and my investment into them, into creating this intimacy that then later translates to the viewer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it makes me, I was real, there's an artist also who, Laurel Nakadati, are you familiar with her work at all? So she would get men who were lonely and, you know, approach her. I don't remember what she used, but then she would go film these pieces, and then like she would pretend to be possessed by a demon and like do like all these things, and it was a large body of work, mm-hmm. and like her people looked, you know, they were critical of her, but I always had a lot of respect for it, because it is learning your power, learning about mm-hmm. desire, learning about other people. And you know, just because it's sad and it wasn't the outcome mm-hmm. that you want doesn't mean it's a bad piece of mm-hmm. work or a negative piece of work. It's something that should be seen, that should be acknowledged. I think that's my, and like we need to, especially I feel like living in a conservative place like you and I do, and that people should be confronting more their dark side or the things that they're uncomfortable with.
Absolutely. And I think I can go back to your previous question with that and my use of the frames and the imagery that I chose, and really using that as a doorway. You know, we're attracted to this beauty. We know these narratives. We know these characters. We recognize the frames, the wood. Are these paintings, right? These are part of our visual vocabulary, and for me to kind of switch something within that and to just make people face it as part of, you know, as a thing that they have to confront right away because it's inescapable. And I try to make it inescapable for people. You know, I lure them in with the beauty and the language, this visual language that I chose that is, it's so embedded in our culture. And then I ask them to think about what's different and why it is.
Yeah, I mean, your works are so beautiful. Like, you want to live with them. You know, you want to have them part of your life. I mean, at least that's how I feel about them. Like, just how they look at you, and they're just gorgeous. But they are also, you know, they are confrontational, and depending on. But let's veer over into religion, and you know, there's some similar, you know, that doesn't come from nowhere, you know, mm-hmm. and you can you talk more about just religion, art, and processing your queer identity, and you know, when did you realize that as a child, and you know, if it's Catholicism is also very beautiful too.
Oh yes.
But yeah, can you talk a bit about that?
Okay. I think so. Growing up in the Philippines, it's religion is cultural. It is familial. It, you know, it's part of everyone's identity. It's, for me, it's inseparable, and that's kind of how I see religion now. Is that it is this thing that I revered because it's nostalgic and it's my familial identity and it's my cultural identity as Filipino. But my relationship with religion as I began this project was tumultuous. I think moving to the United States young, I, you know, carried my relationship to religion that I had from the Philippines, which I loved the church. I thought it was fantastic. It was so theatrical. I loved the songs and the choreography. Everybody knelt together. Everybody stood together. Everything was so opulent. And I brought that over here, and there was a different sense of community. And so I felt I was not part of it anymore in the United States. And then I began to understand the conflict of sexuality and the church, which I never understood as a child in the Philippines. But I think it was hard to produce this work early on, and it started with 4 images, and that was it for a long time because I wasn't prepared, and I wasn't out at the time when I was creating the work. And it really, I credit these images as, you know, as the thing that helped me come out. And to, you know, I never said to my parents that I'm gay, I'm this and that, and I'm creating this work that is kind of blasphemous. But I brought them into the studio and I had them pose as Mary and Joseph. And it's part of the altar piece called Sagrada Familia, and I am representing Santo Niño in it, which is the patron saint of my barrio or my neighborhood in the Philippines. And so that piece meant a lot to produce because that was my coming out to my parents. Like, I was in the studio with them and I was telling them about who I am and that, you know, this is the work that I'm making and that I am struggling with it. But they were ridiculous in the studio. They were just having all kinds of fun. And it kind of, you know, that was what solidified this work for me as something that I needed to do, not just for myself, but for the other people like me that are experiencing it.
Yeah, I think people really connect with it on one level or another. Can you talk then, you know, also thinking about, you know, just where we are as a country, the U.S., working towards accountability as colonizers, mm-hmm. you know, and then you think of the role that religion played into that. Was there any, in terms of just, you know, being from the Philippines, religion's role, the U.S.'s role, does that factor into any of these works as well, or is it more, you know, not obvious, more latent in, mm-hmm. the, in the works?
So the title of the piece or the series is Non Limitangere, and that is a Latin phrase, which is sometimes translated as don't tread on me, but I think the better translation is cease holding on to me or stop clinging on to me. And I titled it this because it comes from a novel that was written by Jose Rizal, which is a the national hero of the Philippines. And this novel is often credited for the revolution for independence, you know, the spark. And he was killed because of his writings. And the images that I make are colonial. They're the result of 100 years of Spanish rule and the religion of the family that I grew up in. I wish, as a Filipino, this is a struggle, because I do want to know who I would be without that influence. But I think it's a big struggle for every young Filipino, because we don't know what that means, because we've been influenced for so long that we don't even know our own language. And so I'm just embracing that my identity is this, and that's, you know, my ties to my family and my culture. But there are other works that I plan on accomplishing that kind of tackles more of a colonial and, you know, the identity of Filipinos, especially Filipino immigrants.
Can you walk me through, like, where you are at in your life when you're making, what starts you off making work to begin with? You know, at what point you're like, you know what, I'm going to make something, I'm going to be an artist?
Okay. Being called an artist was a struggle in the beginning. I just do not like the term, because it has so many ties to it, and it has so many expectations, especially coming from academia or, you know, the institution of galleries and museums. But I understand that that's what I am, and I must face that, just like any other identities that I cling to. So how work is produced, it really is... festers. That's a great word for it. And thinking about what I'm going to produce for the movement piece that has been commissioned by Indie Movement Arts and Big Car, of course. It's something that I've had on the back of my mind, and it's inspired by Mahal na Araw, which is Lenten season or Holy Week in the Philippines. And it's inspired by movements that are performed in the streets as self-flagellation or crawling on the hot pavement from one parish church to another, live crucifixions. And these, like, festering imagery that I've had since a child, you know, these violent self-harm kind of imagery that, you know, it's forgiven because it's in the veils of religion. You know, it's really okay for children to beat these or throw stones, cast stones at these sinners because they are sinners. And, you know, these images and this movement and the weight of it is something that is festering in my mind that I have to produce out there. And that's really where it starts. And I tell my students to create work about the things that they are thinking about right before they go to sleep. Or if you are stuck in silence and darkness, what is it that is festering in you? And that's this work. And it's quite a heavy cross to bear, I think. And so that's why I have to get it out there.
At what point did you consider, like, so tell me, like, so was the Lure series your first go at, like, when you were like, I'm an artist and I'm going to, and what year was that? And where were you at that point? Were you in Indiana? Were you, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So after graduating from Wabash College with my undergraduate degree in fine art and music, I took a couple of years off, and I was creating work, but I was missing community. I was missing a community of creatives and academics, or getting into a community of just artists to look at my stuff. And so I applied for the Master's of Fine Arts degree at Indiana University. And that's where really I began to consider myself an artist and having a career in it. And you know, at that time I was still young. I was unsure of who I was and what I was doing. And that's why I was creating the Lure series. I was creating other series, other photographic works. I was dancing. I was doing all these things to kind of avoid exactly what I needed to do. And I knew that I needed to do it. And that's when, you know, that political event happened and I had to face what I had to get done and what was festering in me.
How did you feel about the response that you got when you first, how was it when you're making yourself so vulnerable?
Hard. And, you know, at the time I wasn't telling people that I was gay. That was a hard thing for me to say. And so to make artwork and to show that vulnerability, I had to be okay with it first. And that took a long time. And then I had to be okay with sharing it with people, and that took so much longer. And then taking a stand, which is what you have to do with your creating artwork and creating such strong imagery, polarizing imagery, is that I had to be strong in my position and my perspective. And so at first, you know, I was. Don't remember because I was numb to it. You know, I cried many times creating the work and or talking to people or in critique or people's responses to it. I had an interview published in a national paper in the Philippines, an online publication, but I, you know, for my own country, you know, to hear about this and what I was doing and the work that I was doing and the backlash that I got on social media, you know, most of it I didn't understand because it was a lot like deep Tagalog that, you know, I speak Tagalog, but it's kind of difficult for me now. And so it was still hurtful, because I feel like they completely missed the point that I'm creating a space for both these things, the conflict, to be okay and for it to be beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I see in those works is not blasphemous or sacrilegious. It's actually a deep love.
Thank you.
For the religion in the works. Like, it's, I feel that. And I think that, I'm guessing that's what you intended, you know, that it's just about trying to, you know, make sense of the relationship within yourself. And a lot of us have that battle. Mm-hmm. You know, and I remember seeing you, I know you gave a talk recently too, and you had somebody hack into your talk, right?
Yes. I was visiting, it was a visiting lecture series for a university, and it was on Zoom, and I, you know, was giving my lecture and into a hall full of students, and my images would be on screen, but I guess they didn't disable the annotations, and so certain viewers were annotating swastikas or the N-word pasted all over this black figure, which is a friend of mine. And so it, you know, it hurt, but I had to keep going and I had to be strong for the students that were in the hall to be seeing this projection of the hate that is, you know, that people still have for exactly what I'm talking about. It just fueled me to keep making the work. And, you know, students came to me afterwards and, you know, thanked me for, and that's always so helpful. And it really just gives me the power to keep going.
Yeah. I mean, most people don't get that kind of reaction. You must have hit a nerve. Mm-hmm. For sure. But, you know, a lot of times when I'm working with artists who are challenging people, and I think your work does challenge people. It's beautiful, but then you're really confronting us all with a truth, and it's a truth that a lot of people like to gloss over. Do you think that, you know, and this is something, and I'm just asking how you feel, you know, because doing this work, like, with Big Car and having a public space to, you know, you do run into people who hate you. And, you know, do you think that you're able to make sense and make space within your work? Do you think that there is a way, do you think art will ever reach some of those people for them to heal themselves? Because I do think that hatred and that anger mm-hmm. is out of jealousy, out of self-hatred, yeah. out of destruction and wanting control of something they have no business. But do you feel like art can help people like that?
In my artist statement, I say, you know, there's a phrase in there that I keep wanting to remove, and it's like, doesn't aim to solve, you know, this conflict. And I keep wanting to remove that phrase, but then I'm like, no, because this conflict is not going to be resolved with everyone or even just myself, right? And I'm just, my experience in being straddling this line and being in these two conflicting worlds is love, you know. I am blessed. I'm so lucky and loved to be doing this, and that's exactly, you know, the message that I want to get across. And I don't fault people for feeling and for having an intense response to my work. That's what I want, you know. But also, I can't solve it for them, and I can't solve it for everyone. And that's a line that I had to draw, and I can't even solve it for myself. And that's a limitation that I had to know that the work will not get to, or any work could possibly get to. I hope, you know, I wish maybe one day somebody will create something that helps at least one person, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's a tough one.
It is. It's like, it is a constant question. It's just like, what are we wanting to accomplish with, mm-hmm. with our work, you know? And if it doesn't, and especially when there's an outside world telling you, mm-hmm. to matter, you need to solve this issue, have
this. Yeah.
So, and I think there's more pressure on the artists now more than ever. People want artists to solve things mm-hmm. that when really end up having more questions.
Yeah.
What do you think, talk a bit about You're really an artist who does everything. You know, you're doing movement, you're making sculpture, mm-hmm. you're even making sound works. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about, you know, so it's not just these visual 2D objects you're making, you're really just all in. They're very yeah. hands-on.
So, you know, to reflect back on a previous answer of having control and having my hand present as an artist, you know, presentation is always a part of it. You know, as a photographer, that's something I had to resolve. And photography has that intrinsic quality of being able to be reproduced or reducing in value because, or perceived value because people think that it's easy or accessible. And so my way of presenting was my way to resolve that, right? To create one-off exhibition pieces and framing and all that stuff. But I think as a person and as a creative, I just have to have lots of pots boiling at the same time because once I focus on one, it'll overboil. a very good analogy. I'll have to put that in my back pocket. But, you know, when I started this work, I also started dancing. As an escape from the work, I was like, I cannot just focus on photography. I had to get out of this studio and get into a different studio. But eventually all these things, that's where, you know, That's where sewing comes from, costuming, dancing, screen printing, laser cutting, all these things that I'm doing off on the side eventually lead back to the same path, and it all kind of goes into the same pot, and then, you know, I serve it to the people.
Yeah, and there was one piece that I wanted to have it in the show, but what, and I can't remember what it was called, but it was almost like the Shroud of Turin piece where it was blood.
Yes.
And tell me about that piece, because I love that piece.
I've always been interested in, well, religion's fascination with blood, right? And its ties to the whole narrative, and partaking in drinking blood, and as well as referencing other artists who've worked with blood, and you know, I really wanted to create an image of myself and insert my own DNA, I guess, into this artwork. And so I screen printed using my own blood and medium, and using my face, because this narrative of Saint Veronica and the shroud is a narrative that I just love dearly. And I, you know, remember my grandparents, my grandma specifically, telling me this story, and I was just like, oh my God. And in the Philippines, I think the story is that, you know, Saint Veronica comes and wipes the face of Jesus, and her veil was folded three times, and so when she opened it, there are three faces on it. And during Lent season, during Holy Week in the Philippines, there's this parade of statues, and every religious statuary from every church in the area comes together, and even home personal like statuaries all come together and is paraded. And I always look forward to this one statue of Saint Veronica holding her veil with three faces on it made from blood. And that's just an image that festered in me that I had to create.
Oh, yeah, I love that piece. Tell us what you're working on next. Like, what do you have just festering now for the future?
Aside from this movement piece that will be happening this month, there is kind of a big altar piece that I'm tackling as part of the Dehan. I need to get this
the
right.
The Dehan Artist of Distinction.
It's like, I need to get this right. Yes, as that was, you know, I applied for that with this altarpiece in mind. And I am tackling the Last Supper. And, you know, I really need to put myself in this gamut of artists that have tackled this specific imagery. And I'm ready. You know, for a while I've been taking a break on creating images for this work, and this is a plan that I've had in the back of my sketchbook for such a long time, and I know my 12 apostles that will be present at this table, all the queer men that have helped me develop who I am today and have partaken in my identity, we will all have a meal together and be represented in this altarpiece.
Oh my gosh, I'm so looking forward to that. So what is your website so we can follow your work, or, you know, and also Instagram?
You can find me on Instagram at kburzon, that's K-B-U-R-Z-O-N, and my portfolio website is kelvinburzon.com, that's K-E-L-V-I-N-B-U-R-Z-O-N.com.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.